Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 16th of November 2014. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the Western Whingers, Gareth James, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, Johnny Fox, and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Made in Dagenham, the musical. This is based on a 2010 film about a strike by the women who did the upholstery for Ford cars in Dagenham, who were demanding equal pay for work of equal value. And there was a big dispute about it. This has been turned into a musical, a book by Richard Bean, music by David Arnold, and lyrics by Richard Thomas. It's been directed by Rupert Gould. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Yes, as you say, it's a film-to-stage adaptation, although the film didn't have original music, so the score has been written for the stage. And the book is, I think, quite different from the film, and that's been written by Richard Bean. I think the most striking thing about the team here is that they don't really have that much musical theatre experience between them, because Richard Bean hasn't written a book of a musical before. The composer, David Arnold, hasn't written a musical before, even though he's written a lot of film music. And Rupert Gould has only done a couple, I think. He did American Beauty and, I think, Revival of Oliver. So it's a team that hasn't sort of done that much in musicals before. And from my perspective, I think that's a positive thing, because I think it's quite sort of fresh in that sense, really. It is, as you say, the story of the Dagenham female machinists. And they didn't just take on the multinational Ford. They also effectively took on the government, and they were also taking on their male colleagues, because their case originally didn't have any sympathy amongst their male colleagues. And it was only after the TUC conference, where one of them made an impassioned speech, that actually they won them around as well. So they were really kind of isolated. And it was a landmark in equal opportunity. And it was only 2 years later that the Equal Pay Act actually came in. So I think it's a really interesting piece of social history, as interesting as the miner strike, which, of course, has ended up on stage very successfully with Billy Elliot. And I think this is successful as well, but in a different way, because this is much more of a musical comedy. It doesn't have the sort of political bite that Billy Elliot does, and it doesn't have the sort of the emotional dimension that Billy Elliot does. But I think as musical comedy, for me, it actually worked very well. I think Richard Bean's book is as funny as his plays often are. Richard Thomas, who produced the lyrics, was responsible for Jerry Springer, the opera. And as you might expect from him, his lyrics are fairly sharp and witty, and sometimes a bit naughty, but I think they suit the characters and they suit the situations. And I think David Arnold's, I wouldn't say his score is great, but I mean the songs are fine. I think there are some nice, some funny songs, some moving songs, there's some quite rousing choruses, and I think, as a lot of people have said, it does kind of, they do end with a chorus which is clearly designed to get you on your feet. Very, very well designed by Bunny Christie. She seems to have taken her lead from model aircraft kits that were used to sort of take the bits off the frame, as it were, in her set, and I think it's quite a sort of clever set. And of course, set in the 60s, it's got that fabulous retro feel to the costumes, where it's a sort of swinging 60s come live again, really. And I think Rupert Gould, has done a very inventive staging. It's got lots of pizzazz about it. It's quite brash, it's got a lot of pizzazz, and I think for me, I mean, the great thing about it was just a lot of fun. I mean, I just, I went to have a good night, and I had a good night. And it was only halfway through previews when I saw it, and I thought it was in very good shape. There's a lot of focus on Gemma Arterton, who plays the lead role of Rita, and she is good, but there's lots of other good performances in there, so it's a shame it is focusing entirely on her. Adrian de Gregorian, who is Mr. Sonia Friedman, gets, I think, probably his biggest West End stage role. I think it's great to see him, moving from places like the Arcola up onto the main stage, to a main stage in the West End. He plays her husband, Eddie. And there are lots of lovely little performances. The one that I adored was Sophie Stanton, who plays a very foul-mouthed Beryl, one of the girls, and she just brings the house down continually. She has some wonderful lines where she sort of teases everybody about did they have it last night and all sorts of stuff. So she was great. They have real-life characters, Barbara Castle and Harold Wilson, who, of course, were the Prime Minister and the Minister for Employment, the other way around, obviously, at that time. And Sophie Louise Dan is terrific as Barbara Castle. I mean, really, really terrific. Mark Hadfield's, I think, a very funny Harold Wilson. But when I saw it, he certainly needs to do a bit of work on his accent, because that was all over the place, to be honest. And there's another nice performance. It's a very hard place straight in all this, I think. And Naomi Fredericks, who isn't, a musical theatre person, you know, has to play the boss's wife, the sort of posh boss's wife, and I think she does that extremely well. And there's a lovely cameo from Steve First, who plays this big brash American who comes over to tell us Brits, put our Brits into our place. So I just thought, you know, it worked for me really well. I'd like to see it again now. I think it's, you know, it's a very British musical. It's a kind of, it isn't like other musicals in structure. I think it's as close to Billy Elliot as anything else, I suspect. I think the social history works. And in a way, because it's so entertaining, I think it brings home that kind of period and that kind of piece of history to people, most of whom probably weren't around then. And I think that's quite a good achievement. So great fun for me. I enjoyed it very much.
Phil, what did you think about it?
Well, first of all, Gareth, I want to correct you. It was American Psycho, the other musical he did, not American Beauty.
Apologies.
Yeah, I mean, like you, Gareth, I went along really expecting to have a good time. Everything seemed right because of the production team behind it, people, Richard Bean, Rupert Gould, David Arnold, and Richard Thomas. I thought, this is going to be fantastic. And the problem I had for you is, rather than finding it funny, although some of it was quite funny, I felt it was just so heavy-handed and cartoonish, which in a way should work in a musical, but for me it didn't. I thought the kind of the standard of humour on a lot of the cases was kind of middle-of-the-road sitcom, and it was really struggling to get laughs. And the night I went, which was the last month of the Monday preview, 2 days before it officially opened on Wednesday, when I assumed the show had been frozen, the audience weren't really laughing an awful lot, and it was really straining to get the laughs. I thought that the music was okay. I mean, some of the numbers kind of were catchy, but in a kind of strident, kind of irritating way, rather than sort of being melodic. The number that is the last number before the interval, Everybody's Out, kind of, it's quite funny in a way, and if I'd been there with Andrew, probably he would have been leaving. He would have taken that as an instruction. And I agree with you about the last song, Stand Up, which I thought was a rather cynical attempt to get a standing ovation, which it didn't get when I went. And I do agree with you about the casting of the women, the sort of the production of the stitchers. I thought for a musical, because there's quite a few of them, they actually all, well, most of them managed to establish some sort of a character, particularly Sophie Stanton as Beryl. I thought she sort of stood out. I thought Gemma Arterton was fine. Her voice was okay, although she can't really do the big numbers, the big notes. And I noticed that they brought one of the girls always to in on the number to do the really big notes. But, you know, that's kind of fine and expected. And I do agree with you about Bunny Christie's sets. I thought using sort of ethics type modelling kits for the sets was absolutely inspired. But I did kind of feel that it, as the show went on, there were no real surprises in the look of the show, and it kind of looked samey, and there were no real sort of standout moments, and it began to look too busy, which I thought the show in itself was. It's kind of busy and relentless, and I thought quite formulaic as a musical. You know, this is a bit of a spoiler alert, was, you know, the character getting that comes, you find out she's ill in the first act, and you know where that's going for a sort of sentimental moment in the second act. So really, for me, huge disappointment, actually. And I can't see it lasting. I think the theatre will be free for Gypsy in early next year.
Nick, what did you think?
Well, if we're starting by correcting Gareth's homework, I'm going to point out that Adrian de Gregorian is actually Mr. Maria Friedman, not Sonia.
Oh, I was going to say that too, yeah.
But that aside, I agree with Gareth rather than Phil. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I think it might struggle. I think it's going to have trouble finding, well, certainly the reviews haven't been particularly glowing for it. And I think a lot of them have missed the point. I've seen some reviews really going for kind of, oh, it's not quite got the political bite. And I think, you know, if you've sat through it and think that was its intention, I think you've certainly not been paying attention. It's very British. I mean, if it is going to succeed anywhere, it's got to succeed here, because it's certainly not going to, I can't imagine what Broadway would make of it. I was actually saying that at the interval, and then as the second half starts, as was mentioned earlier, you've got Steve First coming on as this very stereotypical, kind of in one of the silliest sequences of the whole show, the very stereotypical American telling everybody how it's done. So I think that proves, if anything, they know that they needn't bother trying to impress the Americans because it's not going to happen. I did wonder, especially because it's not just in the show, just the staging is so over the top. I did wonder if, because Rupert Gould hasn't always had the best time with the American critics and his response in America. So I think he was having quite a lot of fun getting back at them in that sequence. Yeah, overall, I mean, it's just so ridiculously British because it is clearly big budget and the money has been thrown at it. So that's why it's going to need to do pretty well to stay open. But like I say, I hope it does because it's so, you don't see a lot of that on this scale of, I mean, one of the things is the lyrics are so kind of deliberately half-baked and, you know, half of the jokes for me was in the desperately trying to cram kind of a bit of scansion and rhyme into the songs. And it's utterly knowing about that. It's all done with a wink. And I really enjoy that. And it's just completely ridiculous. At some point, that song I mentioned by Steve First's American character just kind of devolves into him standing there barking the correct American pronunciation of words like oregano and urinal. So it's, you know, I think it is possibly going to be tricky to find its audience because it's either going to go with how silly it is or it's going to irritate you. For me, I absolutely went with it and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the music as well. I thought it's maybe not massively varied, but it is catchy enough. I mean, it's pretty rare to come out of a musical remembering, for me anyway, to have kind of more than one song stuck in my head. And so that happens with this one. So that's definitely a plus point for me. And yeah, I think so long as you're prepared for, as Piers has said, it's a good night, but it's a completely silly fun night, then I think it absolutely delivers.
I think it's interesting that we're talking about the critics. I mean, they're not all okay or poor, because I think the stage with Mark Shenton, the stage and Time Out and Evening Stand and The Independent all gave it very good review and 4 stars. I think it's interesting that the two weakest reviews have been the Sunday Times Today and The Guardian. Those are two reviewers that are notorious in my book for not having a sense of fun. And I think others are sort of sitting on the fence a little bit, really. So I'm not sure they're universally bad. I think it is a bit of a Marmite show, clearly. You know, because if you'd asked me to predict whether Phil would like it, I'd have predicted he would. So I think... So would I. Yes, exactly.
That's why I went, because I really was up for it. By the way, Metro gave it 2 stars, and they tend to kind of like musicals, so I was quite surprised at that.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's clearly divided people. I have to say, having seen it before the opening night and reviewed it before the opening night, I was very, very surprised, because I was telling all of my friends, you better buy a ticket now, because when this opens, it'll be harder to buy them. How wrong was I?
The night that I went, I mean, in contrast to what Phil was saying, there was a lot of laughs and there was a lot of cheers from the audience, a lot, so... I know it wasn't just me and the friend I went with enjoying it. There was a lot of... But then someone did walk out during the American song, but he might well have been American.
I don't know why they would walk out during that, because I felt that was the number that was kind of to give the show an American interest and to kind of take it across the Atlantic, which I don't think it would do. I think also they'd struggle over there with Harold Wilson and Barbara Carson. I think, you know, anybody even slightly younger, the friend that I went with is late 40s, and she kind of just about remembers Wilson and Barbara Castle, but anybody younger than that, they wouldn't get the even image. There was barely a laugh of recognition when you see Harold Wilson for the first time. And I found that bit actually just, I mean, I thought Mark Hadfield did a good job, but he was played as such a sort of cartoon buffoon that it kind of made the whole thing just silly rather than, you know, get the sort of point across. And the sort of extreme, you know, depiction of the men who were generally all pretty useless and the women who were, on the whole, pretty strong was kind of, it was all a bit too heavy-handed for me.
I'm not sure that they've staged this with the intention of crossing the Atlantic, but it has to be said that Billy Elliot, which was even more complex in terms of social history, and also had Geordie accents, that travelled across Broadway and was a huge hit. But I don't think that's their plan, and I can't imagine that's their plan anyway, and particularly as it obviously would have to succeed here first. The night I went, incidentally, which was the preview, was a full house, and there were an awful lot of laughs and indeed a standing ovation, but probably prompted by the last number.
The night I went, which was the Monday before the opening, I'm told was not a good night by somebody in the know. for some reason it didn't go down too well. It wasn't full. It looked fairly full, but I know there were quite a lot of people there who hadn't paid for their tickets. So at this stage during previews, when, you know, people go and see, you know, the new show, I was pretty surprised at that as well, because I did think this was going to be a hit. I thought the reviews were going to be better than they were as well.
I certainly think it's the sort of show that needs an audience, because it needs atmosphere, I think.
Yeah.
It does need those laughs. And if you don't have those laughs, I think it doesn't kind of sweep you away as much, I would imagine. So I do think it's very dependent on virtually filling the Adelphi, which is not my favorite theatre and really quite a big theatre. And if it doesn't do that, it won't create atmosphere. And if it doesn't create atmosphere, it won't go word of mouth. So it's a difficult one.
We're now going to talk about Cannes by Stuart Slade at the Theatre 503. We don't go to the Theatre 503 enough. It's a perfectly good theatre, but it does seem to disappear from our radar. John, tell me more about this play and what you think about it.
Well, I want to tell you something more about the venue, first of all, because I think it's a very worthy and worthwhile place. And yes, it is a difficult journey for a lot of us to get there, but I think anyone who is adjacent to Battersea or Chelsea or that part of South London really should put it on their radar. Because what it specialises in is new writing, and new writing produced with a degree of quality. They have a fantastic programme called Reactive Writing, where when a new play is produced, they'll have a writer's night, and people are invited to write a response play to it. So that is in turn can be produced within a couple of weeks sometimes. So I think Theatre 503's reputation is as London's bubbling crucible of new writing. And I think it was further enhanced with this piece by Stuart Slade, who's been involved with them for some time. But this is his first full-length play. So Cannes is a two-hander set in a very cluttered garage, where the two central characters are effectively mucking it out and disposing of the remains of somebody's life. The great thing about 503 is that the journey from page to stage is satisfyingly swift. And so Cannes may be the first full-length piece to deal with the fallout from Operation U-Tree, the child abuse incident policing roundup. And certainly it must be the first comedy to do it. So you have Jen, who is about 20, she's at university, and her youthful, hippie-ish Uncle Len are sifting through the belongings, and you gradually discover that they are in the home of Jen's father, who has been a high-profile television personality and very successful. I mean, they suggest he might have had a knighthood. He's won all sorts of awards. There's a canteen at the BBC named after him. But as soon as the U-Tree accusations come forward, his life is turned upside down. He has had, you know, 49 good years and one crucifyingly terrible one, and commits suicide. And so Jen now has to come to terms with the kind of reactive behaviour to that from the public, and she finds herself being spat at in supermarkets whilst also having to deal with the personal loss of a man she just knew as successful, popular and generous dad. They say that the play explores themes of loss and forgiveness, but I think that's more marketing toss than dramatic substance, because what you really do get engaged with is the way these two characters merge with each other and spar, and the conversational writing is of a very, very high quality. There's never a moment when you think, oh, you know, somebody wouldn't have said that. It just is so, so good and so well written that you really do believe both the characters, particularly Graham O'Mara, who plays the Uncle Len. He's a kind of man you probably wouldn't warm to originally. He's scruffy, bearded, hippie-ish, dropout-ish, a bit lazy, a bit casual, not terribly focused, has drifted through life, supported a little bit by this brother who has died. But he is this sort of shifting, smart but hiding it, his comic timing is wonderful. I mean, it's wonderfully timed, sardonic remarks. And I think that Len is one of the most realistic and most fully realised performances I've seen for a long time. Like I say, he's not a man you might want to spend time with down the pub. But by the end of the piece, I liked him a whole lot more than on first sight. And I think that's also a very clever piece of dramaturgy, because rushing to judgment is largely what the play is about. But he really is an exemplar of immersive, intelligent acting. He's a writer and director himself, so I think, you know, this is very much meat and drink to him. But if the part wasn't written for him, he really has made it his own. It's very, very good. I do think the piece only has one idea, and that it could be as easily explored in four scenes as the five that it's positioned in at the moment. But the quality of the writing and his performance really just about sustain your interest. I think that Slade has a nice, original, very British voice. And I'm only offering this as a compliment, really, to say that I just heard echoes in the structure and the attack of some of the dialogue of sort of mid-1980s Sam Shepard. You know, when the two characters really do sort of fire off each other and fight a little bit, I could hear Shades of Fool for Love, and in the sort of description of the family's dysfunctionality, you know, they're echoes of A Lie of the Mind. So I think this is a writer on very good form who has taken a very interesting and difficult subject and given it a treatment that really brings it to the stage in a very positive way. I know Paul didn't like it quite as much, so, you know, maybe you should say what were the failings were from your point of view.
Thanks, John. Well, actually, one of the things, interestingly, I thought after the play was that I thought there could have been a lot more drama in this. I felt that the story started out as being one thing, and then once you understood what it was based on, the Operation Yew Tree type investigation that led to the father taking his own life in a luxury hotel in central London, and then basically the daughter and the mother being outcasts in their own community, I kind of thought there could have been a lot more. And I was thinking after the play, as it was a short bus ride back to North London, just as a side there, the Battersea Theatre is not that far into South London, I would say, but I digress. But I think I would have wished
I thought it felt like the outskirts of Crawley, but
it is only a very short bus ride back into Chelsea. So people should definitely go to Theatre 503 a lot more, including ourselves, because I think the last time I was there was in 2012. But this play, actually, I think, you know, great to be taking such a topical subject, and also a subject that is probably going to be very uncomfortable reading for Britain now and for years to come, because there's still a further inquiry, which will be the inquiry of all inquiries, into how so many people got away with so much of abuse over so many years. And so this whole idea of this incredibly current and topical story, and I would have actually liked a bit more into delving into the whole idea about why they're turning a blind eye and the whole shiftiness, particularly of the Len character. You kind of think, well, why is he trying to just, you know, deflect everything? What was it he knew and all that sort of thing? Actually, maybe that's not a criticism of the play. It was just a criticism that, you know, it could have been a lot more in this whole piece. But I did feel that there wasn't the sense of drama. Once you knew what was happening, there wasn't much of where to go. But having said that, it was funny. It was entertaining for the most part. Probably for what it is in its present form, it is a bit too long, and it could have done, as you said, with perhaps one less scene. But interestingly enough, both Graham O'Mara, who plays Uncle Len, and Jennifer Clement, who plays the daughter Jen, it says in the notes of the playtext, and also I think on the website and so forth, that they had quite a fair bit of involvement in the development of this piece, because it originally started off as a shorter piece called Of Mice and Len, which reading that actually made a lot more sense, because the first scene is all about drowning mice, and as they're drowning mice, you suddenly learn that they're doing this because Jen's mother is just completely beside herself and she's had a nervous breakdown, and they want to stop the scratching because she thinks it's her dead husband scratching and so forth. And so it's the way talking about something trivial then slowly leads into an insight. And this is done in each scene, and actually quite a clever piece about this. And I think, yeah, definitely Stuart Slade is a person that I hope we hear more of. And you're right, John, I think thinking about it, it is very, who's the American author you were referring him to from the 80s? Sam Shepard, yeah. It does feel very Sam Shepard-ish, where offstage something truly horrendous has happened. Yeah. And on stage, you've got characters just relating and not talking about the big elephant in the room and so forth. So it is actually quite clever in that respect. Actually, as we're talking about it, I'm liking it even more. So what do I know? But actually, I think it's definitely a piece that's well worth seeing. And it's on until the end of the month.
29th of November, yes. I think that's how I reacted to it, that I could sort of take it or leave it a bit as we left the venue. But the next, at night and the next morning, I really did warm to it very much more. I just want to ask you if you thought that the cozy and sometimes slightly edgy relationship between Uncle Len and his 20-year-old niece, did you read that as being at all sexual?
No, but there was an underlying sexual current. And actually, the interesting thing about that is that was something that was kind of inferred at certain points, which perhaps could have been explored a bit more, because she's talking about sending pictures of her vagina and he makes a dick joke at some points. And there is this uncomfortable ill ease. And so you start thinking about, well, given that his brother, her father, was also a sex offender, you know, does it run in the family? So you can't help but think it in the audience.
I thought it was very neatly handled, because it gets teased out quite slowly that Jen has been flirting with her university boyfriend by theoretically sending him pictures of her sexual parts. But what she's actually been doing is pulling them off the internet and sending him pictures of other people's sexual parts.
Which is what young people do these days anyway. So it was very believable, I thought.
I dare say it is, yes. Yes, okay. No, well, no. We both then recommend it.
A surprise package.
Put it on your list.
We're now going to talk about 2071, which is just closed at the Royal Court. This is a play, well, a lecture, really, with background slides, being made by Chris Rapley. But it's also been co-written by Chris Rapley and the playwright Duncan McMillan, who wrote the play Lungs, which was on in the Shoreditch Round Theatre season a couple of years back. It's being directed by Katie Mitchell. This is her second sort of collaboration with a scientist talking about global warming and other things about the future. The first thing she did was in 2012, she did 10 billion with Stephen Emmett, who in about a week upstairs at the Royal Court painted an incredibly depressing picture of the future. I think his final line was to point out that a colleague was planning to teach his child how to shoot a gun in order to survive well in the future. This particular, I'll keep calling it a play, is not so polemic and not so depressing. Well, perhaps just as depressing, but feels a lot more scientifically based, feels as if there are a lot more facts and that there is always hope. The title of the piece, 2071, comes from the fact that Chris Rapley's granddaughter will be the same age that he is in 2071, and so he's kind of looking at what the world might be. Chris Rapley is a very, I think, senior scientist. He's been director of the Science Museum. He is the chair of the London Climate Change Partnership, professor of climate science at the University College of London, and he's also done things like the International Geosphere Biosphere Programme and director of the British Antarctic Survey. So he's got an awful lot of experience, especially of the places where we see the climate is changing. And this isn't going to surprise people who've read about climate change, but he does provide a lot of facts, and he does walk you through the basis for the ideas and all the worries about climate change. It does feel that you're being given the facts in a calm way. It's not trying to scare you too much, although it does scare you, and it's not trying to be too polemical. It is a very bare idea of the facts, what atmospheric carbon's doing, whether we're reaching a limit from which we are gradually going to get a temperature rise which will be unsustainable for comfortable human life on the planet. It's going to be very difficult to actually kill everybody. The planet has been warmer in the distant past when there was plenty of life and even proto-humans. So it's not going to kill us all off immediately, but it could easily kill a lot of people off and cause a lot of disruption and chaos in the world.
I did wonder about this because it is sort of a lecture. It is more of a lecture. He is reading it off a teleprompter, which hangs off the circle. I did wonder if it should be a little bit more dynamic. He's just sitting down. He's giving us the facts while there are projections behind us, which illustrate some of the things he's talking about, mostly in the form of graphs. So even that isn't particularly dramatic. But I did think it well worth watching. The only thing I would complain about, I think, is that it's preaching to the converted. There's no one there who wasn't receptive, even if, like me, I mean, I thought I knew most of the stuff he said. He cleared up one or two things I might have thought about, but he was preaching to the converted that everybody there is going to know about this or care about this, even if they don't know the facts, and he will be filling in information for them. There's nobody there who would stand up and say that he's talking nonsense, and I think the thing is he wasn't, and because he's not being too polemical, too political about it, it would be very difficult to argue about. But I would have liked to see somebody try, and I didn't feel that there would ever be anybody in the audience who would. What did you think about this, Gareth?
Well, I mean, I agree with the point you just made, really, about preaching to the converted. I mean, my sort of big question is, you know, what's it for and who is it for? Because there I was sitting in a royal court audience. So I would imagine, you know, looking at the demographic, that it is likely a significant proportion of them are both aware of climate change and concerned about climate change. So therefore, you are preaching to the converted. And I just couldn't see the point, to be frank with you. I just couldn't see the point of it because, as you say, he just sits in a chair reading for 65 minutes. The backdrops, to me, didn't illuminate or illustrate anything. It was just moving wallpaper, the backdrops. He would have reached more people if he'd published this and allowed us to read it instead of him reading it to us, making me feel a bit like a child in a newspaper or pamphlet of some sort. And it's the least dramatic thing that's ever been on the Royal Court stage. So even though the subject is dramatic, the delivery isn't dramatic. It's slow, it's dispassionate, it's dry, and frankly, it's really rather dull and inert. And there were quite a lot of people dozing off in the theatre because just in an ironic twist, the Royal Court turned the heating up so much, which for a piece about climate change I thought was deeply ironic, to the point where it was actually very uncomfortably hot in the auditorium and people were dozing off. Because it is the sort of piece that is quite soporific, really. I don't argue with his points. I mean, he did go to a scientific depth I haven't been to in my sort of reading and watching about climate change before. So certainly there was more depth there. But to be honest, a bit too much for me. I mean, I was struggling a bit with that. But, you know, it's not a piece of theatre. This is a piece. This is a, you know, as you say, it's a lecture. It's a man sitting on a chair reading. And I, as a theatre goer who went to the Royal Court, even though I knew it was about climate change, I wasn't expecting a man sitting in a chair reading to me. I actually felt a bit cheated, really. So, you know, for me, this is a bit of Katie Mitchell self-indulgence, really. And this is the third disappointment in a row at the Royal Court for me, and the fourth this year. And I genuinely feel there are quality control issues here. I think the Royal Court is losing its way. This is the place where in the last sort of 10 years, we've had groundbreaking theatre like Jerusalem and Kleinborn Park and Enron and, oh, so many things, you know, one has to. And here we are, filling the space for 2 weeks with a man sitting on a chair reading to an audience of people who already believe in what he's saying. So I don't feel as, I think you're being kind to it. I'm just a bit angry, really, because I think it's, I just think it's a very misguided event, I'm afraid.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook. On the web, we are aoiultp.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.